140 people were killed and more than 600 others were injured in the attack, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
People here say the bombing of the funeral ceremony at the Asana al-Kubra Community Hall revealed the brutality of the Saudi-led coalition against Yemenis. They say Riyadh's crimes will never be forgotten and Saudi Arabia should be brought to justice for its crimes. عبد اللطيف الوشلي صنع.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in the Syrian capital Damascus and met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. They discussed the military condition in Syrian soil. President Assad stressed that work will continue until liberating all Syrian territories from terrorism and ending foreign illegal presence. Talks also covered regional and international developments, including the situation in Afghanistan. Amir Abdullahian briefed President Assad on the Iranian nuclear file negotiations, expressing Iran's goal to achieve sustainable development. He said Iran wants to cooperate with its neighbors to break the economic siege on his country and neutralize sanctions imposed on the Iranians. Amir Abdullahian also underlined the importance of boosting economic cooperation with Syria.
In the past weeks, we reached important agreements for a full development of relations between both countries in all fields, as well as setting programs for implementing such cooperation agreements in economic, trade, and tourism sectors.
Amir Abdullahian also discussed with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad recent developments, including the results of his talks with Lebanese and Russian officials related to the Syrian crisis. Maqdad expressed Syria's full support to Iran in its nuclear file.
Syria fully supports Iran in its efforts in the nuclear issue. We strongly condemn the U.S. moves aimed at manipulating Iran's nuclear program and other regional affairs.
This is the second visit for the top Iranian official to Syria in less than 2 months. His trip is part of an international and regional tour which started in Russia. Abdullahian's visit sends a clear message to the enemies of the resistance alliance that decades-long ties between the two countries are constantly developing, despite Western and Israeli pressures on both states. It's clear that the two countries maintain the same stance that resistance is the only path to victory in the face of their mutual enemies. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
An official France-Africa summit was organized by French President Macron in the southern French city Montpellier. He had invited state-linked members of the civil society and entrepreneurs. But even there, official participants criticized the colonial and paternalistic attitude of France in Africa. Later at the protest march and the counter-summit, held at the same time and in the same city, African analysts and human rights watchdogs said that France continues to exploit African countries, transferring uranium and other natural resources to Europe.
The position of France concerning authoritarian and dictatorial regimes has not changed. This was obvious when Macron went to Chad to support the son of former dictator Déby. France is maintaining its policy of political and military interference to defend its economic interests. France has not changed in this respect.
Political analyst Aziz Fall from Burkina Faso said that France is losing ground in Africa and is therefore using new tactics to seduce the civil society.
Well, basically the French power is losing its grip in the region, and this is a major change compared to the so-called Cold War era. We have seen Russian, we have seen Chinese coming to the fierce competition, and we are witnessing a new scramble. The Americans are here, so the French need to review the way they will access to wealth in the country, and this is supposed to get rid of the support they have offered to these sellout leaders that are still leading our country.
Migrants formed a dynamic part of the protest march, demanding the end of evictions and official documents for everybody. Thousands died trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea. Those who succeeded this dangerous adventure became undocumented workers in Europe and faced the risk to be sent back every day.
Yesterday, Macron spoke to the African and French youth about culture, sports, and entrepreneurship. My question to him would have been, how can we be partner with France or Europe, given their policy which cost the life of 2,000 young Africans in the Mediterranean Sea only during the last 8 months?
President Macron says he wants to change the relations between France and African countries, But the pretty words at the official summit do not hide the facts on the ground. Undocumented workers have been arrested upon arriving here in Montpellier and received orders to leave the territory. Macron, with his anti-migrant policy, continues fishing in the waters of the racist far right. And that's a dangerous game. Christian Hunt, Montpellier.
Campaigners outside the Liverpool City Council, opposing an upcoming arms fair in their city, home to people of Yemeni and Palestinian heritage.
We are a safe haven and we are a safe place for refugees and people fleeing war. So why are we, on the one hand, being a refuge and on the other hand, selling the weapons that are causing the destruction to life and land and liberty?
The arms fair is set to kick off here in a few days, showcasing plane and missile components, drones and other military hardware. The building is owned by the city council that campaigners say has refused to cancel the fair despite months of protests and petitions.
I think we have a very right-wing council. They have a mask, they wear a mask, and they try to face both ways. They call themselves socialists, but they implement cuts to vulnerable people. They don't oppose the Tory cuts at all, and more shockingly than anything, they have said they are powerless to stop the arms fair.
Starting on October 12, the fair will provide a venue for some of the world's most notorious weapons makers, the UK's BAE Systems, which has made a bomb selling arms to Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis to be used against Yemenis. Elbit Systems, a UK-based Israeli company accused of testing its deadly armaments on Palestinians. And American firm Raytheon, also a major supplier to Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
For the last 20 years, Britain has participated in a series of absolutely catastrophic wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, that have caused murder and mayhem around a huge arc of the world. And we really need that to change. And unfortunately, at the moment, our leaders are refusing to learn any lessons from those disasters.
Today's protest follows days of similar action against one of the world's largest arms fairs held in London just last month. And they're all calling for an end to arms exhibits in the UK and the government's unquestioning support for arms exports. Saeed Pourreza, Liverpool.
The Boycott Divestment Sanctions Movement, also known as BDS, has called for a boycott of the ongoing Dubai Expo. BDS is a transnational Palestinian-led organization that works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and pressures Tel Aviv to comply with international law. The delayed Dubai Expo 2020 kicked off on October the 1st and will be held over the course of 6 months. It is the first time that such an initiative is taking place in the UAE, according to BDS. Both the UAE and Israel are shamelessly using the World Expo to whitewash and distract attention from the dismal human rights violations, war crimes in Yemen, and the criminal oppression of migrant workers.
BDS urges to boycott political, cultural, sporting initiatives used by Tel Aviv to show that Israel is a country where peace and harmony rule and there is no system of oppression against Palestinians.
The Dubai Expo has been awash in controversy since day one, with the European Parliament urging nations not to take part in the initiative. The legislative branch of the EU has cited human rights abuses, the jailing of activists, and the autocratic government's use of spyware to target critics.
EU Parliament's calls to withdraw from Dubai Expo 2020 also included the main sponsor of the initiative. According to Palestinian citizens residing in Italy, the EU could take a much firmer stance towards holding the UAE government accountable for its ongoing systematic oppression of Palestinians and its utter disregard to international law.
The EU should boycott Israel in the first place. If Brussels really believes that the expo has to be boycotted, it should say it more clearly. The EU always has a double standard when it comes to the Arab world.
The Dubai Expo takes place against the backdrop of a growing UAE-Israel military security alliance, starting with Abu Dhabi's import of billions of dollars worth of Israeli security and military technology in recent years. Max Civili, Rome.
Barricaded and heavily guarded, the show of force by the local government against peaceful protesters who want to present a memorandum at U.S. Consulate for the release of Pakistani neuroscientist Dr. Afia Siddiqui, who was kidnapped along with her three children by the FBI agent with the assistance of the local secret services. Protesters are outraged over what they call the Khan administration's failure to stand by its promise to bring Dr. Afia home. She had been sentenced to 86 years in prison by the U.S. Afia protests coincided with the arrival of U.S. Deputy Secretary Wendy Sherman and her seven-member delegation exempted from the COVID-19 rapid antigen test and body scanning on arrival.
Our establishment is so in awe, it's awe-stricken with America, that it won't even let a peaceful delegation go to this, to just send a memorandum, that's all. It goes to show that the Tehreek-e-Insaf establishment has nothing to do with Insaf.
Heavy contingent of police was deployed to stop the march miles away from the U.S. consulate.
This is a peaceful demonstration. We just want to go to the American consulate. We just want to submit a memorandum in which it is written that Afia is innocent. The war is over. The American forces have flown back. We have given a safe passage. 5,000 Americans and NATO soldiers in negotiation. We can't even bring our daughter back.
Later, two members of the protest were allowed to submit their memorandum.
This is just for the security purpose. We have stopped them here. And now a small contingent of their is moving towards the consulate to present a memorandum of the protest to the consulate.
Although U.S. war in Afghanistan is over, but with broken promises by repeated Pakistani governments, Afia's family doesn't seem that lucky. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The importance of timely marriage, having children and increasing the population. The 3rd of February, 2021. Well, now that we are discussing the issue of family, I wish to say something about marrying at an appropriate age and without any delay. You, dear eulogists, who are an important and valuable medium in our country, later on I will expand on this matter, should promote these issues. Marrying on time and without any delay is a necessary task. Having children and increasing the population is an important and fundamental responsibility that should be carried out. Both of these issues, early and timely marriage and increasing the population, is one of the vital needs that the country has in the present time and also in the future. Well, these concepts should be given a due place in your eulogies. Of course, I wanted to discuss these issues with more detail, but because there is no time and we are close to noon, I am mentioning them briefly and quickly. Eulogy recitals are a special and unique artistic phenomenon. Let us turn to the issue of eulogists. Eulogies are a special and unique artistic phenomenon, which have no peers anywhere else in the world. Of course, in Western and non-Western countries, they have concerts and occasions like that, but it is radically different from eulogies. Managing a group of participants and managing eulogy is a wonderful thing. Fortunately, its best and most numerous example exists in our country. Of course, this phenomenon exists more or less in some other countries, but fortunately, its perfect example exists in our country. The comprehensiveness, media influence, and social popularity of this particular art do not exist anywhere else in the world as they do here. First of all, eulogies is a combination of several arts: the art of poetry, the art of singing, the art of managing a group and a ceremony, the art of efficiently conveying the message to the audience in an artistic and innovative manner, and the art of having a good voice. This is the artistic aspect of eulogies.
According to the Environmental Protection Agency, the United States of America produced 35.7 million tons of plastic waste in 2018, more than 90% of which was either landfilled or burned. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Hannah Seo, writer. This article is published under the heading U.S. lags behind most of the world when it comes to plastic pollution regulation. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. In recent years, countries across the globe have implemented laws to mitigate plastic production and pollution. In the past 2 years, nations like Sri Lanka and Belize have passed ambitious national laws to phase out a number of plastic products like bags, cutlery, and straws. But the U.S., a leading producer and consumer of plastics, remains woefully behind, even as it stands as one of the world's biggest polluters. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, the country produced 35.7 million tons of plastic waste in 2018, more than 90% of which was either landfilled or burnt. The U.S. ranks second in the world in total plastic waste generated per year. In 2019, the U.S. also opted not to join the United Nations updated Basel Convention, a legally binding agreement aimed at preventing and minimizing plastic waste generation that was signed by about 182 other countries. More than 90 countries have established or have imminent plans to establish either bans or fees on single-use plastic bags or other products, according to data from the nonprofit ocean conservation organization Oceania. The U.S. is not one of them, though Americans have been aware of plastic pollution as an environmental concern as early as the mid-20th century. U.S. action against plastics has been piecemeal. The federal government has left it up to individual cities, counties, and states to decide whether and how to regulate plastics. Plastic problem is growing increasingly urgent. More than 1 million plastic bags are used every minute, with an average working life of only 15 minutes. Experts believe the ocean will contain 1 ton of plastic for every 3 tons of fish by 2025, and by 2050, more plastics than fish by weight. Not only does the ocean and all life reliant on it suffer from plastic pollution, but human health is also at risk. Microplastics have well-documented impacts on human health and have been found in 90% of bottled water and 83% of tap water. U.S. incessant plastic consumption is cultivated by throwaway culture, fueled by the plastic and oil and gas industry's efforts to sustain high plastic consumption while distracting people with recycling companies. However, a new proposed federal bill, the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act, offers potential solutions and could transform the U.S. from a hindrance to the global movement against plastics into a much-needed ally. Such federal action could help stop the fractured approach to tackling plastics in the U.S. and shift the burden from consumers to plastic manufacturers. Advocates say even if the bill doesn't pass in full, its component parts, especially those that are more bipartisan, could likely peel off and be recycled into other legislation. For example, a part of the bill addressing plastic pellets or nurdles has already broken off and become its own piece of potential legislation, the Plastic Pellet Free Waters Act. Other countries not only produce less plastic than the United States of America, but they have also more successfully legislated against plastic pollution. Dozens of countries across Africa, Asia, and Central and South America have legislation in place to quash the single-use plastic crisis. Christy Levitt, the U.S. Plastic Campaign Director at Oceania, told EHN that the EU directive is just one example for the U.S. to emulate. Oceania has surveyed countries around the world, taking inventory of the global anti-plastic legislation and assessing where the U.S. sits comparatively, and found progressive policies in many pockets of the world. Chile passed what is, if not the most comparative, one of the most comprehensive single-use plastic foodware policies in the world, Levitt said. Beyond banning single-use bags and straws, Chile prohibits all eating establishments from providing single-use cutlery or containers. Grocery and convenience stores must also display, sell, and take back refillable bottles, creating a cyclical system of bottle reuse. As early as 2002, the East African country Eritrea banned plastic bags in its capital city, Asmara. The country implemented a nationwide ban on the import, production, sale, or distribution of plastic bags in 2005. Rwanda banned plastic bags in 2008, and then all single-use plastics in 2019, with heavy fines and even jail time for anyone found importing, producing, selling, or using single-use plastic items. When countries across the globe with fewer resources than the U.S. successfully push out harmful plastic products, it gives the U.S. no excuse to be so behind. In the absence of national legislation in the U.S., local governments at the city, county, and state levels have regulated plastics. As a result, there is a diverse set of mandates and ordinances scattered across the country. One paper in the Journal of Environmental Policy and Planning says that as of August 2019, 8 U.S. states, 40 counties, and nearly 300 cities had adopted policies that either through a ban, fee, or combination thereof, aim to reduce the consumption of single-use plastic bags. To Rachel Cruz, a public administration researcher at the University of Kansas and author of the paper, it's curious to see such a large issue regulated to local governments. We tend to say that policy responses should be at scale or in proportion to policy problems, she told EHN. But local governments aren't at scale with climate change. Local governments aren't at scale with global plastics. And yet, in a lot of places in the U.S., that's where we are seeing the action happen, unquote.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instrumentation.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, millions of British people could fall into fuel poverty this year. That means that some would have to cut back on the basics in order to be able to heat their homes. This gas shortage and price rise follow empty pumps at petrol stations, where due to a shortage of truck drivers, Brits have had to wait in long lines to fill up their cars. Even the government has brought the army in to drive trucks to try to fill the supply gap. But all of it seems to be pointing to mismanagement by the government. Stay with us as we take a look at it all on this spotlight. Let's cross over to London, start off with Amina Taylor. Amina, give us your take. What's going on?
Yeah, this is shaping up to what some commentators are saying is a return to the bad old days. The old phrase, winter of discontent, being thrown around here, because not only did you have those rather unsavory scenes of empty fuel pumps and consumers queuing up to get a little bit of petrol for their cars if there was any to go around, you're also combating and trying to balance that with issues in the breakdown of the fuel supply train. You're also looking at a situation where energy firms, some of the smaller ones who were able to perform and provide a little bit more competition in the market, going bust. So on one hand, you have fuel issues at the pumps, and at the other hand, you're looking at fuel issues for the homes. And as always, you have the most vulnerable consumers having to deal with some very real crisis-making decisions about whether or not they can put food in their bellies, food in the bellies of their children, or perhaps provide fuel for their vehicles to get to work, to get to some crucial jobs, or to heat their homes. So I think many of those who would have listened to the Prime Minister's speech a little bit earlier in the week will be wondering what parallel universe Boris Johnson is living in, when so many of his subjects will be wondering just how they will make it through the winter this month. And unfortunately, I believe this is just the beginning of things to come, and unfortunately not the beginning of the end.
Well, I mean, just staying with you briefly, because the Prime Minister has tried to show a brave face and said that things are getting better. I mean, your assessment of people's reaction on the ground, I mean, do they believe this? Do they believe that things are getting better, or are they feel that it's getting worse?
Well, they don't have to believe if it's getting better or worse. They just have to look at the realities on the ground. And even though one might think that the Conservatives would be a bit further behind in the poll, they're not, which tells its own story. But it's also about when this starts to bite a little bit more, because even if individuals didn't have the major issues with their vehicles, maybe these individuals will not be affected by the rise in domestic fuel prices just yet for their homes. When some of these price caps go and people are renegotiating the cost of energy to their homes, they'll really start to feel that bump. And we're talking about hundreds of pounds for even the most conservative estimate here. So unfortunately, it's not a matter of whether they have an impression of what's going on. The reality will soon come to bite, unfortunately. And it's those lower to middle income families that will feel it the most. £400 is nothing to somebody who's earning a lot of money. But believe me, when you're already counting every penny, this is just enough to push you over the edge.
Thank you so much, Amina Taylor, correspondent in London, for that report. I'd like to welcome out of London now author and historian Marcus Papadopoulos. And out of Edinburgh, writer and political analyst John White.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us to start this off. With Marcus out of London. I mean, Marcus, the government says the fuel crisis happened because there were not enough drivers to supply the service stations. But did the government not calculate this ahead of time? I mean, why was the situation allowed to reach such a critical point?
Well, I should first of all start by saying that, currently speaking, there is no energy crisis in the UK. Further to that, there is no food crisis either. Recently, I travelled from London to Pembrokeshire, stopping off at numerous places along the way. I saw no signs of an energy crisis. I saw no signs of food shortages in any of the supermarkets which I visited. It is certainly the case that a couple of weeks or so ago, people were stockpiling petrol or diesel, and that did cause a short-term problem. But the people who were stockpiling petrol or diesel did so on account of mainstream media outlets in the UK putting out completely uncorroborated, unsubstantiated stories saying that there will be a petrol crisis in Britain. I would also add as well that it is certainly the case that many of these aspects have been mismanaged by the current government. But then this is a problem that has been plaguing Britain for many years now. So we hear about how there will be in Britain this winter a rise in electricity and a rise in gas. But year in, year out, there is always a rise in energy prices in Britain.
So Marcus, are you saying this has been created? I'm sorry to interrupt you. So are you saying that this has been created by the media? And if so, why?
What I believe is that British mainstream media is depicting something in order to distract the British public from a lot of very serious problems at home. It is certainly the case that the British government has relied too extensively on liquefied natural gas. Also, the British government should have put politics aside and should have sat down with the Russian government and secured an energy deal with Russia, which would have resulted with an uninterrupted flow of Russian natural gas. But alas, the British wanted to put politics first, and as a result, if there is to be a shortage of gas this winter in Britain, that will be the fault of the British state, and the ordinary British man and woman will pay the price. And it goes back to what I said moments ago. There is always a rise in the UK every single year in the price of gas and electricity. Why? Because energy was privatized many years ago in Britain. Why is it that people in Russia do not struggle to pay their gas bills or their electricity bills? Why? Because electricity and gas has been state run. It is not, electricity and gas does not exist in Russia to make a profit. It exists to provide people with electricity and gas. The same cannot be said, alas, in Britain.
Right,
electricity and gas is used by the British state to make money. Like public services in Britain are used by the public state to make money.
All right, stay with me, I mean, because I think we're going to get into the whole, then we look at neoliberalism and what has happened in the West because of those policies. But let me get John in on this conversation. John, your take, you heard what Marcus said, that basically this has been something that has been exaggerated because basically there really isn't a crisis. What do you think?
There is a crisis. It's a global crisis. Excuse me, I'll just change position. The light's in the way here. It's a global crisis caused in large part by the surge in demand for fuel post-COVID by economies all over the world. But Brexit has exacerbated that crisis due to the supply chain issues created by Brexit. The just-in-time supply chain system adopted by the UK has broken down because the importation of vital supplies and basic necessities have been interrupted by increased custom controls and bureaucracy. So there is a multiplicity of crises, and the UK has been in the eye of a storm because of COVID, but also because of Brexit and all the problems that it has unleashed.
Okay, and to our viewers, hopefully we will establish that video connection right now. That was, of course, the voice that you could hear of John. Hopefully we'll establish a better connection. I mean, Marcus, you say that basically you had driven through the country and you went to various stores and you did not notice it. So tell me about when we have been seeing long lines at petrol stations. We have been shown shelves that have been half empty, and we've had people actually had interviews in the UK with individuals on the street that are complaining about the current situation. I mean, what do you say to this? Hasn't the country gone from crisis to crisis, or do you not see it that way?
Well, I must first of all clarify something. There is no global energy crisis. Such an argument is completely untenable. For example, there is no energy crisis in France. There is no energy crisis in Germany. There is no energy crisis in Italy. Indeed, there is no energy crisis anywhere in Europe. Why? Because Europe or the European Union and also individual countries which make up Europe have secured concrete agreements with Russia to receive an uninterrupted flow of gas. Those governments put their people first by wanting to ensure that their industries and domestic households would not be left without electricity or gas at any time of the year. Now, returning to the UK, yes, it is certainly the case that for a few days there was a shortage, and I have to use the word shortage in a very loose way, a shortage of petrol and diesel, not because there was a lack of petrol or diesel in the UK. It was because British mainstream media was putting out stories, as I said moments ago, completely unsubstantiated stories, which caused panic. And as a result, people were stockpiling petrol and diesel. People were going to their local petrol stations. They were taking jerry cans with them. They were filling them up. And that was causing a short-term problem. But that only lasted for a few days. Furthermore, it is the case that in some areas of the UK, supermarkets were not bare. They were not empty, but there were certainly products which were not available. But that was only a few cases. However, British mainstream media has depicted a completely false picture by saying that the whole of the UK is experiencing a shortage of energy and a shortage of food. That is simply not the case. And I believe that part of the reason for this false portrayal is to distract the British people from some very worrying developments at home. And I'm specifically referring to these changes which the British state is imposing on the British people vis-a-vis what is known as COVID-19. But there are also many other problems in Britain. For example, there are 14 million people in Britain living in poverty. That includes 4 million children. 4 million children living below the breadline. Now, one of the tactics the British state has used over centuries to remain entrenched in power is to distract the average British man and woman from what is happening in their society.
Okay.
So, for instance, they will say that Russia is causing the energy crisis. They will say that Russia is a threat to the freedom and democracy of Britain, because they are distracting the British people from the terrible measures and the terrible problems which are plaguing the British people.
Okay, stay with me, Marcus. Let me get John back in on this. John, your take. You were shaking your head partially while Marcus was speaking. Your take on this.
This is not a crisis that's being fabricated by the British mainstream media. There is a material crisis. It's largely a result of the post-COVID demand for energy around the world, especially on the part of the Chinese and Indian economies. European countries are suffering fuel shortages, but not to the same extent as UK because of Brexit, and also because they have larger and better storage facilities. For example, under the May government, the largest storage facility in the UK that could hold the gas reserves, the fuel reserves, for up to 3 months was shut down by Centrica, and now we only have the capacity to store fuel for 3 days. So that's had a material effect on the crisis. Gazprom is refusing to, or certainly up to now, has refused to go beyond the contract it agreed with the UK and other European territories for its supply. Putin recently voiced his opinion on the matter, saying that he will not let this crisis go to a certain point. He will look to increase production under Gazprom, which is a Russian state-owned energy giant. But there is a crisis globally because of the demand. COVID has accentuated that crisis. We've had a crisis of haulage because of the shortage of HGV drivers, which is also part of the crisis because European drivers can't get into the UK as easily as they did under the EU. Northern Ireland is not suffering the same crisis because it still operates under the single market as part of the Northern Ireland Protocol. So I do respectfully have to disagree with the Thrust of Marcus's points on this matter.
Well, John, you feel that what you're calling these various crises, that it has been exacerbated by Brexit? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. We have different customs arrangements with the EU. We're not part of the single market. We do no longer have frictionless trade. Boris Johnson lied when he said that his oven ready deal would still maintain frictionless trade. And so it's caused interruption in supply chains, and that has fed into a crisis. So as I said, there's a multiplicity of factors involved, but the issue is that Brexit has only sown dragon's teeth. Rather than free us from the clutches of the dictatorship in Brussels, as its main drivers would have maintained, Nigel Farage and the right wing of the Tory party, it has only made Britain isolated, and it just confirms that Brexit is an entirely misplaced understanding of Britain's role in the world in the second decade of the 21st century. It is an emotional reach back in time to a supposed golden age when Britannia ruled the waves and the Union Jack flew whatever it damn well pleased. And guess what? You can't eat a flag. A flag doesn't eat a hole. It doesn't put food on the table. And this is a result of false consciousness.
Marcus, your thoughts on that? I mean, do you feel that the Brexit has played a role in all of this? Or do you feel that all of this is part of what you said, basically just trying to deflect some other problems, more serious problems that are taking place there?
Well, as I said moments ago, Britain has relied on liquefied natural gas, and Britain should have looked to Germany as an example of ensuring gas, an uninterrupted flow of gas for British industry and households by securing an agreement with Russia. And in the last few days, we have seen a most bizarre chapter with British mainstream media. Because first of all, British mainstream media outlets were running stories saying that Vladimir Putin to increase the supply of natural gas to Europe to avert a crisis. Then within 48 hours or so, the same media outlets were saying that Vladimir Putin is going to decrease the amount of natural gas to Europe to instigate a crisis. It really is preposterous nonsense. I also do not believe it any role in this. I believe that whilst I support Britain withdrawing from the European Union, the European Union is not a socialist entity. It is a neoliberal, culture-hating, religion-hating. It's inflicted horrific damage on the lives of working class people across the European Union. One need only visit countries in Central Europe, such as Hungary and the Czech Republic, and in Eastern Europe, such as Romania and Poland, to see how factories have been as a result of the European Union. But it is most certainly the case, and I've been saying this for many years, that Britain is a country plagued by many illnesses, and this has been the case for centuries. Why? because the British state, different to the lives of the ordinary British man and woman, wherever they are in the Union, in England, in Scotland, in Wales, in Northern Ireland, they simply do not care. And when I say the British state, I mean the British establishment, for example, the royal family and the aristocracy. For instance, energy should not have been privatised. Electricity and gas should exist to ensure that people do not go cold in the autumn and winter months. Electricity should exist to provide people with lighting at any time of the year. But because the British state values money above all else, it privatised energy. And it is absolutely true that for decades now, not just since Brexit, for decades now, British people in the autumn and winter months have been fearful of putting on the heating because they are afraid they will not be able to pay their energy bills.
All right, let me get John in here because our time is running out quickly. But John, how is it that London still considers itself as Great Britain when it appears that it is getting more and more difficult for it to even keep millions of its people from simply freezing to death? I mean, it really does not sound like a first world country. Your thoughts?
Well, the British political establishment no longer runs an empire, but does operate under the illusions of an empire mind, and this is fed into Brexit. It has also managed to persuade a large swathe of working class people that the Union Jack is the way forward rather than class-based politics, which Marcus has eloquently laid out. I do entirely agree with the large part of the problem is not supply, it's ownership. Energy should be under state control. It's a necessity, it's a basic necessity. Privatisation has been an unmitigated disaster. But the entire Western world is going through the same crisis of late capitalism. But the British state's answer to that crisis, which 2008 global economic crash, has been to withdraw from the world, withdraw from reality, and wait and lose itself in illusions of grandeur based on a misplaced understanding of the British Empire, a failure to address the real history of that empire. So this is a problem of a lack of understanding of Britain's role in the world, a lack of understanding of the empire, or the British obscurantism fed by myths surrounding the Second World War and Britain's role in the Second World War, and the demonization of Russia.
Okay.
Russia is the biggest country in Europe, and the idea that you can isolate Russia, that you can have a Europe that's going to be stable without Russia being included as a major partner.
And on that note, I'm so sorry I have to interrupt. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me on the Spotlight. Marcus Papadopoulos, author and historian out of London. John White, writer and political analyst out of it.